KZSU Stanford, welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture. My name is Dave Levine. I am a non-resident fellow at the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School, as well as an assistant professor of law at the Charlotte School of Law in Charlotte, North Carolina. Thank you for tuning in today to the show. Today I'm very excited to have on Professor John Walensky of Stanford University, who's written a fascinating book called The Access Principle: The Case for Open Access to Research and Scholarship. John is a prolific scholar as well as really, I think, a leader in this particular movement of making the case and then attempting to do something about the idea of getting access to, by way of the public, to research and scholarship that might otherwise not be accessible. And we're going to be having a wide-ranging discussion today dealing with commercialization efforts and how we deal with those issues, some IP, although I will say up front that that John is not a lawyer, so I'm not going to certainly ask him for his legal opinion, but we can at least discuss some of those issues. And then more broadly, discussing why it is that the public might want access to research and scholarship. Yeah, for those that listen to Hearsay Culture regularly, you know that many of the guests that I have on the show are professors who are writing scholarly works, I think excellent scholarly works, and scholarly works that deserve a wider audience than one might normally get by publishing in law reviews or other academic journals. And so in that very small way, I feel like I'm contributing to the effort that John has spearheaded in trying to get open access to these works. So, you know, I oftentimes will reveal my biases up front. I am an admirer of John's work, and so I come at this from a very sympathetic position. That doesn't mean I may not push back, as I often do, but I do want to reveal that point as well up front. John's background is quite interesting. He has a BA in English from Laurentian University, a Master's in Education from the University of Toronto, and a PhD Sociology of Education from Dalhousie University. Prior to going to Stanford, he was the Pacific Press Professor of Literacy and Technology on the Faculty of Education at the University of British Columbia. And in fact, I had the pleasure to meet John as he was making the transition to Stanford. He works on a project which we'll be discussing in a little more detail in the interview called the Public Knowledge Project, which is focused on extending access to and accessibility of knowledge through online sources. We're going to be discussing that in much more detail. Unfortunately for me, we were kind of two ships passing in the night, as it were, because I wound up leaving Stanford as physically as John was coming there. But it's certainly, certainly a great person to have at Stanford and an asset to university to have someone focusing in this area. So it sounds like a love fest that I've just thrown out there, but we are going to have this discussion, fairly wide ranging, and hopefully be able to plumb some of the whys and wherefores of John's work. So if I've done my job properly, at the other end of the line is John Walensky. John, are you there?
Yes, Dave.
Thank you so much for joining me on Hearsay Culture, and I want to make a special thank you to you because you've been particularly flexible as I've had various scheduling logistical issues. So thank you for your flexibility, and thank you for taking the time today to join me on the show.
My pleasure.
Let's jump right in, and what I like to do with all of my guests in order to contextualize these issues is kind of ask a little bit more about your background. So what beyond what I've mentioned, what is your background in this area, and particularly how did you wind up getting interested in this particular scholarly focus?
Yeah, I think the key piece that you didn't cover is my career as a school teacher. I began as teaching in elementary school and have always been involved in public education, in the education of the public in a broader sense. So my interest in access to knowledge, my interest in whether there weren't ways to make research and scholarship more widely available are based on a notion of kids' interests and learning, the whole idea that we're teaching kids to read for something greater and so that they can contribute and learn more about their society even after they leave school.
The particular focus that you have, I guess, is an interesting one to explore a little bit. So as a school teacher, what age range were you teaching, and how did that experience color what you're doing now?
Actually, I don't think it was the age so much. It was middle school, so these are, 12 to 14-year-old students who are just sort of awakening to a larger world of knowledge. They were interested in science projects. They were concerned about political issues. They were beginning to gain a sense of the historical order and patterns of the world. And at, I mean, the school library was one resource, and we would have a single encyclopedia. But largely, we had an old book room full of textbooks, and it was a fairly limited range and world they were that was accessible to them. And so, one of the first really exciting developments in in the early days of the web was when Beowulf, when the British Library put Beowulf online. And all of a sudden, students, this is the early 90s, and I had actually finished teaching school then, but I was still working in schools, still working with students. So all of a sudden, we had original sources that students could have a look at, and just the excitement around that ability to extend beyond the kind of confines of the school and the limited book budget and the textbooks that we had available. Suggested that there were possibilities around just access to knowledge, that the internet had opened up and then was certainly an educational purpose that seemed worth pursuing.
The many of the guests I have on the show are coming at this from a legal standpoint and certainly a background as lawyers. You're coming at this from a different perspective than the traditional guest, if you will, on Hearsay Culture. And coming at this from having spent, you know, your career both as a student and also professionally in the education discipline, when you discuss these issues, I'm curious, with people outside of your discipline, do you find that there's a lot of commonality? And indeed, the larger question is how much interaction ultimately is there between the people focusing in this area from the educational aspect versus the technologists or the IP people or any number of others?
Well, and Dave, I mean, the key still is going to be research for researchers and scholarship for scholars, and I don't imagine, in fact, I think there's still a very important aspect to this, and that is that scholars don't have complete access to the world of knowledge that's available, and certainly scholars in developing countries or at less well-endowed institutions don't have access. So I think we have to keep this in perspective. I think most of the focus on open access or increasing access has been scholars within the scholarly world and to increase access within the scholarly world. I bring that additional element of saying, well, if we're going to make it available to all of the scholars, it would cost us no more to make it available to all of the world. And we have very interested amateurs, we have concerned parents, we have professionals in law, education, medicine, all of whom could benefit and at times, not every day, but at times, are very interested in pursuing issues in more depth. And those issues are available, I mean, treatments of them, are available in scholarship and scholarly journals and in research journals, and I think we could increase access to those resources.
The perhaps to contextualize the discussion before we get into what we mean by open access and your efforts, as you outline in your book and in your projects, perhaps it would be good to kind of take a little bit of a historical perspective. So, you know, perhaps you could lay out the general state of play on this issue prior to the internet in terms of those very issues of access. What were the difficulties, the challenges? What were the major questions that one would ask?
Well, in the world of print, we can call it that. The journal is founded in the 17th century, and the journals developed along with scholarly monographs and scientific books in a kind of steady pace, and there were university libraries, and the resources were available. Certainly, there were always differences around prices and concerns about who could afford what, but it was... there was a difference when the internet came, and that was the possibility of much greater access. And so up to the development of the internet, I'd say the key issue was the cost of the difference in cost between journals published by commercial publishers and those published by nonprofit societies. And so in the 80s, the 1980s, and well into the 1990s, even in the 1970s in a sense, the price differences between the commercially published journals and those that weren't commercially published was causing a serious problem. In fact, the libraries had already named it the Serials Crisis.
Mm-hmm. And what exactly was the reaction to identifying this crisis? Was it literally the advent of technology making it an issue that could be addressed, or was there a middle ground?
I think most of us tended to ignore it. As faculty members, we would, you know, get these lists of journals that we were asked to cancel or to suggest cancellations among the list. But I think most of us treated the Serials Crisis as that issue in the morning when everyone ran downstairs and grabbed their favorite box of cereal and found out that they didn't have any left of the one they liked. And it was the internet really that said there could be something radically different. When faculty members discovered in the 90s that they could put their articles that they had published in a journal that had a circulation of 500 or 600, they could put those same articles up online and get much more traffic, interest, engagement, critique, that we realized that there was another way that knowledge could circulate. The printing press had multiplied greatly the availability of scientific information compared to the letter or the illuminated manuscript, certainly. And this was a new technology that seemed to, again, multiply the possibility that, of circulating knowledge on a global basis and with access to scholars everywhere.
The this gets us starting to discuss your book in more particulars. Or perhaps I'll just ask the standard first question, which is your thesis. What is your thesis? What are you trying to achieve with the access principle?
The basic thesis is that at its most fundamental level is that people have a right to know what's known, and that anything that restricts, unduly restricts that access to knowledge, impedes the entire world of learning. And so, of course, I'm not suggesting that information should be free or that there are no costs involved. I'm just challenging this world of scholarly communication with this notion that we could increase access, that there are ways of circulating this information that will not destroy the economy, that will not reduce the support for peer review, for the scholarly rigor that we bring to these articles and to the work that's published, but that could afford a much greater access by which people will benefit. I mean, the public good of the work that we do needs to be realized among scholars universally, but also among professionals and policymakers and the interested public.
The way you articulate this, it sounds to me fairly uncontroversial. I mean, you're not suggesting, as you just said, well, to me anyway, being particularly sympathetic, but I'm going to push back a little bit and ask you this. The nature of what you're describing, of course, intersects directly with, to put it colloquially, one's ability to earn a living. So I guess I'll ask the question to get us into some of the topics that you discuss in the book and develop it a little bit. In terms of the scholar, the individual scholar's interest in sharing their information and sharing their research and sharing their scholarship, what would be the core reasons why a scholar would want to do that? And then the countervailing question being, why wouldn't they?
Well, the key here is the particular economy, if you like, of the scholar's life. That we work on a reputation economy, on a sense of contribution and recognition. We're not paid for the articles that we submit to the journal. The journals get them for free. But the reputation and the sense of contribution we are paid for, in the sense that we retain our jobs or that we get promotion, that we are able to obtain positions at the different institutions. So the scholar's interest, if you like, is contributing to this common good, is having their work circulate, is having a sense of the value of it recognized. So anything that impedes the circulation of a scholar's work unduly, and I want to be not too legalistic about this because, as you've pointed out, I'm not a lawyer, but I mean, I don't want to suggest, again, that there is no money involved. I just want to suggest that we need a more rational system by which the costs of this of the circulation are justified. There's probably $10 billion in the current economy of scholarly communication, particularly in science and technology and medicine. So my sense is there's sufficient money on the table, but could many more people have access to that knowledge for that same price? And that's my case. I think the answer is yes, and I think there are enough experiments, enough successful experiments, and enough, in fact, they probably shouldn't be called experiments anymore, enough journals that have pushed back in terms of the costs, that have found ways of increasing access, whether by releasing their articles after a number of months, using the subsidies that they receive from grants to fund the journal entirely, having authors contribute from their grants. There are just a series of different experiments that have gone on since the Internet has been introduced that have suggested that the knowledge can circulate on a universal basis and that the money that has been used to support the journals in the past can continue to do that, but just in different ways.
To push back a little more before we get to what I think you've largely defined, but open access, let me kind of pose this to you. If I'm a researcher, and this is something we'll discuss in more detail shortly, but if I'm a researcher or a scholar who's being paid by a private entity to create white papers or any other kind of paid research, and I'm being paid handsomely for that work, at the moment that, and I'm asking it in a somewhat, you know, crass and narrow way, but I want to get your response to it. Once I've received the check that is delivered to me for the work that I've done, and I know that the work is going to be published in that realm, what is there an overwhelming interest that you think and I know it's an unfair question, but the average scholar in that situation might have to say, you know what, it's not good enough that I've been paid and that it's going to be published, but I'm really going to push for this information to now be made more widely accessible beyond the control of the particular publisher?
Dave, I think it's you can play on both poles in human nature. You can talk about the vanity issue, and that is there's a vanity element in being widely known and having one's work circulate, and there's an altruistic notion of contribution. And even the agency that pays you well has an interest in seeing their work distributed widely. I mean, one of the issues today in terms of the private university, this is my first experience with a private university, but part of the challenge that's coming today around the endowments and the tax exemption status of the university is the public purpose that it's serving.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the institution's interest then is also in having their work widely available. And in fact, the standards today for making a document public have to do with putting it on the internet and have to do with making it reducing the transaction cost to a point where people can easily access it.
Mm-hmm.
So I would say that it's in everyone's interest. I mean, the element of secretiveness and the kind of Isaac Newton retention syndrome, if you like, the reluctance to share one's data, to share one's knowledge, because it is open to critique. The more widely it circulates, it is open to review and to criticism. And so there is an element of that, and I do run into that in talking to people about that. But there, on the other side of it, and again, I try to appeal to their better nature, but sometimes I'm reduced to this vanity argument because the research shows in a field like physics that the number of citations, the number of times your work is quoted, if you make a copy of it that's been published in a journal, if you make a copy of it as well and place it on the web, which the publishers will allow you to do, the number of citations will increase by a factor of 2 or 3.
Mm-hmm.
And so in some vain sense, you are 2 or 3 times more famous because you've been quoted that much more often. Well, that's a little bit crass. But there's clearly, within the spirit of scholarly work, a sense of contribution. And I think this distinguishes the intellectual property of learning, if you'll let me use that term, the intellectual property of learning distinguishes it from other kinds of intellectual property where the value is entirely realized on the number of sales, on the right to exclude those who do not pay for it.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, and you know, it raises a point, and since you mentioned it here, I think it's one that we can explore. Yeah, you see slowly, especially when you, at least when I read blogs that focus in the IP area, you start seeing this benchmark that's coming out measuring scholars in particular and their impact based upon the number of downloads that they have on SSRN. And so certainly that kind of evidence would lend support to the idea that there's a vanity or some kind of credibility aspect to countervail what might be just a purely commercial interest. But it leads to a larger question. And perhaps I'll just ask you, what's your view of entities like SSRN that in fact are for profit, but at the same time allow for, at least within those particular disciplines, the ability for scholars to post not only completed works, if assuming that the publisher allows them to do it, but drafts and see comments, or something like BE Press, which comes out of Berkeley, which is a similar model, but comes from the nonprofit world. Is there a difference between SSRN and BE Press because of their relationship, and as you describe your relationship with Stanford, that bears noting as we think about these issues?
No, I mean, I would want to make some distinctions here, and one of them, the distinctions I don't want to make, is that for-profit is evil or bad or wrong,
okay,
and nonprofit is good. That's not the issue. The issue is access to knowledge. And the measure I would hold, and the measure I would hold, in fact, to give credit to SSRN, the Social Science Research Network, is that its business model is based on, first of all, providing access, and then charging for value-added services on top of that. And so that, to me, is a step forward. I'm not trying to be, I'm certainly not an absolutist on this. It has to be free or nothing. My concern is that we're increasing the access, and we're continuing to find new ways to increase the access. So CERN allows you to see a scholarship before it's published, because one of the issues in publishing is the delay and time it takes to get a work out. It allows you to interact with that. In other words, you can email the author. You can begin to contribute and build on the work that's there. And all of that part is free. And then, sure, there's a vanity factor in the number of downloads. You can, you know, look at your hit parade or your scorecard,
mm-hmm,
in those areas, and that is an aspect of it, certainly. But the important thing for me is that it's contributing to a greater circulation of that knowledge and information. If you want to, you can subscribe to an abstracting service from CERN. There's a financial side to that. You can purchase articles that they make available on the site from other publishers. And they get a piece of that action as well. But the critical aspect is that CERN has contributed to a greater access, and that, to me, is the primary measure. Not the only measure, but the primary measure.
To turn to your book, so you organize the book in an interesting way with one-word titles for each chapter: opening, access, copyright, associations, economics, cooperative, development, public, politics, rights, reading, indexing, and history. And I want to ask you, you know, for those that are interested in the book, but perhaps who haven't read it, how did you choose to organize these topics, and what were the criteria that you used to decide that these were elements that you wanted to focus on to, as you say, make the case for open access?
Well, that's exactly it, Dave. I mean, The notion of I was building a case for open access, and I would have a series of file folders to make that case. And the case for open access can be made, and the chapter titles, one-word chapter titles, were based on a notion of file folders. So the copyright question, I would argue that copyright is one of the chapters and one of the points on which the case can be made. Copyright, in fact, supports open access because copyright supports the interests of the author. And the interests of the author in the case of scholarship, and not in the case of other fields, but in the case of scholarship, is in increased circulation. Not in increased subscriptions, not in increased revenue for the publisher, but increased circulation. Similarly, a title like development, a file folder like development, the case for open access and the development question, I hope seems obvious to people, and that is that developing countries want to participate in this knowledge economy, and their ability to do so is curtailed by the lack of access. And one of the great successes of open access in the last 5 years has been the availability of information at the University of Ghana in Lagan. The library there, I had the pleasure of visiting, and the librarian very proudly told me that they now had 19,000 subscriptions.
Hmm.
And 5 years ago or 10 years ago, they would have had a handful, maybe 100 subscriptions. Hmm. But they went to 19,000 because publishers have recognized that electronic access forbidding or refusing electronic access to developing countries is unconscionable, because the cost of providing it is virtually nothing, and the lost sales, if you like, or lost revenue opportunities in developing countries were zero,
mm-hmm,
because they were not going to be able to subscribe.
So the
book is organized as it were to take on each of the elements and to build the case for open access across issues like politics, in terms of the public's right to have access to information to participate in a democracy. The human rights issue, and it's very fundamental, and in fact going back to the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which recognizes the right of people to not only have the benefits of science, but to have access to the knowledge, to scientific knowledge. And so it was the sense that in fact the case for increasing access could be looked at from a wide number of a variety of perspectives, and the book then is organized, as it were, as a series of file folders.
Yeah, it's with regard to the market effect, and it's an interesting outcome that the lack of a commercial market for these journals, I think, well, you could correct me if I'm wrong, may have very well made it easier for the publishers to do this. But it kind of leads me to a question with regard to a concern. Are you concerned that as publishers realize that there is potentially a commercial market for these publications, that you could actually wind up having the opposite effect, that suddenly there will be in discussing this with Brett Frischman, an enclosure movement of sorts, in other words, an effort to try to regain rights and control over the distribution of scholarship and research based upon the fact that the publishers suddenly or slowly recognize that there is a broader market for this work than they previously perceived?
Yeah, that is a real issue. And again, I would suggest, in fact, the American Psychological Association, which has been one of the strongest opponents to open access, because their business model is based as a professional association on the revenues from their journals, threatened at one point, not threatened, but reached out, I guess I would say, with the notion that they wanted to do an iTunes of psychological articles, that you would have a 99-cent download for their journal articles. And given that the current rate from Elsevier, for example, is $40 an article, some are charging less, but that's a very common example, a very widespread example, because Elsevier has 2,000 journals. The 99-cent model for a wider public access, to me, is a huge increase, a huge improvement, I should say, in terms of how available this knowledge is. So I'm ready to, as it were, support compromises or alternative models that are focused on this very basic premise that we should be increasing access to knowledge if we're concerned about the democratic and educational quality of our society. And so I'm not I'm open, and in a sense I think you have to be, because this is an emerging market. This is a new world of publishing. And the idea that there will be one model, or the idea that we have that model in hand already in the first two decades, seems to me very naive and unrealistic. So I think we have to have a series of goals or principles that we're guided by, and then we have to be open to suggestion, innovation, and the emergence of new approaches and new ideas. I mean, I'm sitting now, as it were, in the capital of innovation in terms of technologies, and I'm ready to see where this is going to go.
We're going to take a very short break here. When we come back, I want to get into some of those policy issues, in particular, what you talk about as evidence-based policymaking and how your efforts may contribute to that. You're listening to Hearsay Culture, an interview with Professor John Walensky of Stanford University, author of the book The Access Principle, The Case for Open Access to Research and Scholarship. For those of you that listen to Hearsay Culture regularly, you know that this show begins on KZSU, Stanford's radio station, and therefore now is the time in the show when I ask you for money. But that money should go to KZSU. KZSU is a nonprofit, non-commercial radio station at Stanford University, and it relies on donations from listeners like you to maintain its diverse programming and to make sure ultimately that the lights go on. If you're interested in making a donation to KZSU, you have a couple of options. You can go to underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. Again, that's underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. Or alternatively, you can email underwriting and then also click on donate to KZSU on KZSU's webpage, which is at kzsu.stanford.edu. So you have two opportunities to attempt to make a donation to KZSU. Regardless, I do hope that you continue to listen to KZSU's diverse programming and Hearsay Culture. So John, let's return to the discussion involving your book, The Access Principle. And I want to ask you, in your introduction to the book, you lay out one particular area that you develop in the book, which is the argument that public access to research intersects with what you define as evidence-based policymaking. And it's a term that is out there. Perhaps I'll ask you to define that term and then draw the connection.
Okay. But just before I do that, I should point out that some of the listeners may be thinking about the contradiction here, especially after you just asked for money,
right?
In terms of me selling a book and at the same time talking about increasing access and the potential of open or free access.
Fair enough.
And I should mention then that the book is available for free to download online at MIT Press. as well as being available in hardback. And for those of us who are traditionalists and feel, certainly I do, quite attached and perhaps too sentimentally, but I don't think so, to the world of print and particularly to the world of books.
Well, you've eliminated what would be an obvious contradiction admirably, because that does come up any time that I speak to anyone.
It seems not to have hurt the modest sales that any scholar might expect in this case. But the question about evidence-based policy is an important one, and part of my argument that goes beyond scholarship for scholars, which I think is still the core, is the idea that research could be playing a greater part. I mean, the majority of research, certainly in the big-scale studies, is funded by the government, by taxpayers, if you like, by those deeply concerned about policy issues, and the availability of it to policymakers is an important factor. The evidence-based policy movement, if you like, which seems so obvious. I mean, why wouldn't you have evidence for a policy before you went ahead with it? But it's really an attempt to provide a rationalization of policy in the sense that the evidence needs to be clearly stated, that studies need to be conducted, and that existing studies need to be called on. And at one level, it's easy enough to imagine that policymakers do have this kind of access. But what we discovered in a study of policymakers in Ottawa, in Canada's capital, 25 policymakers that we interviewed, is that they were depending increasingly on open access research, on research that was freely available online, to find their evidence. Because they had such limited budgets in terms of being able to subscribe to journals, particularly the wide range of journals that a given policy mandate might be interested in or need access to. And so the question not only of the policymakers but also of the public's ability, if evidence-based policy, which I think is an admirable thing, is going to become the standard, then how does the public begin to contribute to policy if they're excluded from the evidence, if they don't have an ability to check the facts, if they can't, as it were, assemble a case themselves? And so we're seeing a push. I mean, in my field of education, for example, No Child Left Behind, the legislation of the Bush administration very clearly states, in fact, repeatedly, an emphasis on scientifically based research as grounds for introducing new programs and for appealing for federal funding. And again, my question is that if we expect school teachers, school administrators to take advantage of this information, then we have a responsibility to facilitate their access to it.
It leads to another question regarding apathy. Now, right now, and particularly apathy with regard to policymaking by the public generally. We're in a primary season right now, so at least some data is suggesting, at least with regard to the primaries, that more people are voting, and that's certainly a good trend. But let's assume for the moment that the general level of apathy that I think has existed and has been established on the part of the average the average voter, let's say, remains in effect. How do you deal with the issue that ultimately, again, putting aside researchers, but the public more generally, may simply not be interested in accessing these articles?
Well, I would start realistically with the premise that the public is not interested in all of the research that's published, and in fact is only interested on occasion when affairs touch their lives. And so the best example of that is in the area of health information. The federal government, the U.S. federal government, with the National Library, through the National Library of Medicine, has the best life sciences index online called PubMed, and the public does visit this very sophisticated, full research database because they have issues of concern, because they are deeply motivated about a health issue in their family or for themselves. And in the policy area, I don't think there's nothing closer to our lives than our health, obviously, or the health of our family. But at a second level, if you like, or at one or two removes from that, there are times when citizens are deeply concerned about issues. And the whole question about universal access to health care right now in the United States is one of those issues. And a number of groups have mobilized around that. And when there is an advocacy group, and again, on both sides or all sides of the issue, my feeling is that they have a right to the latest research on these issues. And again, I would recognize that that research can be abused, that it can be selectively put forward, that it can be misinterpreted, but I don't think that's a reason to exclude people from having access to that information. I don't think that's a reason to, and again, the apathy issue, the fact that I expect a limited public interest on a very periodic or episodic basis in this research isn't a reason to forbid or to not forbid, but to put up barriers, or in fact, let's put it positively, to not facilitate as much access as possible. The public does not need to qualify in terms of this access to this knowledge that, in fact, they have funded and that has been conducted in the name of a public good. I think they have a basic right to it, and the degree to which they exercise that right is an interesting question. Mm-hmm. But I would add a second element to that, and that is that as someone doing research in the area of scholarly communication, as someone who's interested in public education, well, yes, I do have a responsibility for how that information is presented, and I do have a responsibility for helping people have access that goes beyond just handing out journals in a bus or putting journals up in a store window.
Right.
And so the project, the Public Knowledge Project, which I work with, mm-hmm. A good portion of its research focus is how do we put that research up in a way that the public and professionals and policymakers can make greater sense of it, can feel greater assurances, and can as it were put tough questions to that research, can compare studies, can look at how those issues are handled in other media like government policies or in the New York Times and newspapers. So we're looking at ways of providing a context for the research that is put online and that is now much being made more accessible.
It leads to another question, which is ultimately who is going to do this? We've discussed SSRN and BE Press. We've seen efforts to put other kinds of information, like recent efforts. The show is being recorded on February 12th, and just this week, it was announced that a large amount of federal court decisions have been placed online in a usable format. And it leads to the question of who. In other words, who is going to ultimately take the time and effort to do this?
What I am.
Where?
People, I mean, again, we're a very small group of people committed in terms of doing research in this area. Mm-hmm. And our approach has been that we need to improve the quality and reduce the costs as we move this work online. And so the example I was using before of providing support for the public, part of the Public Knowledge Project's work has been to develop open source, that is free software, that enables publishers or journals or small societies, groups of scholars, to publish journals in a way that reduces their costs because the system automates a lot of the clerical elements and the software itself is free, but that also provides supports for public access. And just to give you one example, what we do when an author submits an article is we ask that author, in terms of a journal using our system, we ask the author to submit a number of keywords, which is pretty common, but then through a script we take those keywords and we make those available in a series of buttons beside the article, and so a reader looking at an article is curious about an issue and thinks that they've read about it recently in the newspaper, so there's a link that says show me the articles or show me related pieces in the New York Times or in the Washington Post that deal with this subject, and it uses the author's keywords to find it, it goes to that database and it shows it to the reader. Similarly, we have other databases so that the reader can say, show me the related studies, because I want to see if this study is common or this study is, in fact, way out there and without other studies that agree with it. So we build a context through these automated systems that allows a reader to make critical judgments about research, even if they're new to this field, even if they're not sure that they should be comparing studies, that each study, as it were, is part of the whole. We're providing a series of easy-to-use links and buttons that suggest that before you take this article before a school board, before you take this research paper to your physician, you may want to check a few of these different elements and, as it were, build your case or at least be in a position to judge whether you have information that would be valuable.
And the web address, again, for those that you've just made a compelling case, and I'm going to check it again and play around with it, the web address for the project.
The web address, so this is the Public Knowledge Project, right. And the web address is very simply pkp.sfu.ca.
Excellent. Let's. I would be remiss whenever we talk about open access to research and scholarship. I think along lines with apathy, I do want to ask you about the other climate, which is the security climate that we currently live in. And I, rather than characterize it, suffice to say that we have a society right now that is largely interested in maintaining secrets and control over information. How do you address that concern? And I guess I'll ask specifically, what do you say to those who would say, well, I don't want defense contract research that may be done by an academic available openly? Are there limits to open access from that perspective?
There certainly are. And I think one of the points of pride about Stanford University, and certainly one of the reasons I feel very good about coming here, is Stanford's refusal to do classified research. It does Defense Department research, certainly, but only that research which can be made publicly available in published journals or in whatever format. And I don't want to suggest, again, that I'm an absolutist, that every piece of knowledge or every aspect of research should be published and made freely available to everyone. I think there is a reason for classified research, and I think there those reasons need to be respected. But I think the standard here, I think we need to understand that scholars are, as it were, compelled and judged by their publication, and not simply to get it in the journal, but the publication is to make it public. Mm-hmm. And so what's at issue here is not whether an article will be made public or not. That is, if a professor is inclined to publish something, they've already decided to make it public. The question is the degree to which they make it public. And 30 years ago, submitting it to a journal was as public as you could possibly make an article, apart from taking the off prints that might be sent to you and handing them out in the bus again, is my favorite example here. But today, the standards for making an article public is not sufficient to simply submit it to a journal, because the opportunity, and certainly the publishers now support this, the opportunity to post it subsequently after the review process on your website or in the university archive, so increases that element of public that has now become the standard. And I think that's the critical aspect. So the questions about security and the questions of sharing information and elements of recognition of, as it were, of the sensitivity of information. I think that certainly in today's climate, we need to respect those, or we need to challenge them at times when we feel that they're not being applied fairly, or there's an undue restriction. But I want to keep the open access issue as a separate one, because the open access issue is simply a continuation of the question about publishing.
I do want to ask you, and we have about 10 minutes left, so I do want to get into this a little bit, although I recognize we don't have enough time to discuss it thoroughly. But, you know, in the context of what has been defined by Jamie Boyle, the IP scholar with whom I know you're familiar, cultural environmentalism, how does your effort, the Public Knowledge Project, intersect with what we understand as cultural environmentalism? In other words, what hopefully will become a practical movement to encourage more access to information generally, and of course this, you know, particular group looks at it from an IP and economics perspective in particular.
Yeah, let me take at least a swipe, as it were, at that. I mean, I think the initiatives, and you might take Larry Lessig's notion of free culture, the initiatives in the free culture movement, the sense in which there are 50 or so million objects out there in the web that have a Creative Commons license that allow people to freely use it, the Wikipedia phenomena, one of the most popular sites on the web is full of anonymous contributions, and sometimes controversial, there's no question about that, but then knowledge is controversial in its most interesting aspects. There are a series of movements alive. The number of independent bands, for example, that have made their name on MySpace by freely distributing their music. So this is part of a larger movement, and my concern is very much that the university is not left behind in this sense. Let me use the Wikipedia as a kind of sterling example. Many faculty members are concerned that their students use, return to the Wikipedia as a reliable source, even though the Wikipedia's policy is very much no original research, And they're pushing back all the time on the question of are there enough references in the work. So my concern there is that until the research is available so that we can create links to the Wikipedia articles, until we begin to explore how the world of scholarship can connect to this larger cultural environmentalism, if you like, this larger open culture, then the university is not playing the public role that I think it should. And one of the studies we did was on Wikipedia on the use of open access articles as references, that is, articles that a reader of a Wikipedia entry can then go and check or can explore further, can get more depth. And we found that 2% of the articles in the sample we looked at had 2% of the Wikipedia entries at the end of that entry would have a link to an article that was freely accessible and that was, in fact, research that had been peer-reviewed. And against that 2%, we asked ourselves, what could it be? What was the potential here? And we found that 60% of the articles might have had, that is, there was free online research available for 60% that would provide good references and wonderful educational extensions of Wikipedia entries. 60% of the entries that we looked at could have had these articles, as it were, attached to them among the existing open access research, which, again, I should point out, we estimate that about 15% of the research that is now published today ends up in an open access format that is freely available through the author's website or the university library or the journal making it available through one means or another. So this possibility of the contribution of the university changing its position, but more importantly of this knowledge being repositioned as part of the public domain, the public sphere. The public domain is slightly different legal question because of that we're still retaining copyright when we talk about open access. We're still, as it were, retaining some rights around attribution and non-commercial use. So this notion of research becoming positioned in a different way and not simply a matter of the city on the hill, the campus, as it were, as the center of knowledge, but of the university contributing to a larger global phenomena.
Mm-hmm.
And again, I would come back to that phrase of the democratic and educational quality of our lives that it would be contributing to. That to me is the basic principle.
With regard to that 15%, and I guess, everyone has their own perspective and somewhat myopic view, and I guess I've been lucky in the sense that I write in the intellectual property sphere, and it's unusual to find an article that in some format, at least a law review article dealing with intellectual property, that you might be able to find in an open access environment. But I'm curious, to the extent that you have this data, are there particular disciplines that are more apt or more likely at this point to endorse open access?
Yes, and do I have a good explanation of why?
Right.
Yes. So let me give credit to law, by all means. And CERN is part of this, by the way. But law is a very open field, and economics, the dismal science, as it were, is a field that has a very strong level of open access. But the winner, in terms of access, is high energy physics.
Huh.
There's a tradition in high energy physics of circulating preprints. There is a sense of urgency and very rapid development in high energy physics, given the speed that particles travel at and all of that sort of thing. And so 90%, maybe 95% of high energy physics work is available, freely available, particularly at a site called archive.org. And at the same time, the scholarly journals, physics, physical letters, all of them have, as it were, over the last 10 years when this phenomenon has been going on, have not suffered. And we often use that as a good example of how the journals coexist with this open access. So it is, there are fields that differ. In the humanities, generally the level of open access is very low. In medicine, there's a growing movement because of the urgency of health information. The New England Journal of Medicine, heaven forbid, has all of its content available after 6 months. And again, I think there's an ethical issue in terms of restricting access to this kind of information. So the phenomena is developing. It is developing unevenly across the disciplines because of different traditions, because of different developments, because of innovations, and because of interest. But I think the general phenomena is, and I think it is part of a larger one, that you've just addressed, Dave, and that is that there's a sense of expectation, a sense of greater openness being a good, a public good, and a sense of the contribution and interest in this knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
And so that it's not just, as it were, an academic interest, but the idea that we educate citizens for a lifelong interest in the world. And sometimes it's urgent in a personal way. Sometimes it is intellectual curiosity, which I think should be just as celebrated as any other element in terms of our lives.
Your book is quite provocative, and like I said, while I find it less controversial than many, I could definitely see areas that become more controversial. And although we only have a few minutes left, I do want to mention at one point you suggest that there's a connection between journal prices and human rights. And you do point out that you're making a claim which is quite broad, but perhaps, and I'm sorry to do this because we're short on time, but in a very brief response, what is that connection in your view?
Well, I mean, it's a point I have referred to, and that is this human right to know, and I think that the costs of journals have to be justified against that right to know, and that is the difference. And again, it's, if all journals were at the same price range, then I wouldn't have a case. Then there would be clearly an inherent need for that price, given that all journals are at that range. But we have a difference in prices right now by factors of 5 or 8. That is, the prices of one journal on a per-page basis, in terms of the same quality, the factors can differ so radically that I don't think there's a justification. And then my critique of that, I mean, you could say, well, it's anything you can get away with,
right,
in terms of business. And in a sense, they are getting away with it. But I think the human rights element here, and the primary example that is often used is brain research, which costs $26,000 a year to subscribe to. I think there's a human rights issue in terms of access to that knowledge, because the number of institutions that can afford a journal like that are very few.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that has to be justified in against the notion that this information has been publicly funded in terms of the research, and that there is a basic claim on that as a human good.
The author is Professor John Walensky of Stanford University, author of the Access Principle, the case for open access to research and scholarship. John, you mentioned it several times, but I do want to mention it again. So for people that want to learn more, again, that web address and other resources that you might suggest, including, again, access to your book.
That website is PKP, the Public Knowledge Project, pkp.sfu, Simon Fraser University, .ca.
Excellent. John, thank you so much for joining me today. I certainly invite you back to continue the discussion, because I know that we've only scratched the surface. But thank you for joining me today on Hearsay Culture.
All right, Dave. Well, thanks. Your questions were provocative, and I welcome the opportunity.
Terrific. Thank you. Bye-bye. You've been listening to Hearsay Culture and Professor John Walensky of Stanford University. The Public Knowledge Project is really quite something, and in fact, it's this website definitely worth checking out for anyone interested in these commons issues. For people that are interested in listening to Hearsay Culture, other than live on KZSU, you have a number of options. You could go to hearsayculture.com, and there you can find all of the previous shows as well as the schedule and occasional blog entries. You can also go to the iTunes webpage. Speaking of Stanford University in particular, the Center for Internet Society's iTunes podcast page is the location where you can also find all of Hearsay Culture shows. And you can find that by going into iTunes and typing Center for Internet and Society. And lastly, you can also subscribe to the RSS feed on cyberlaw.stanford.edu, again, CIS's webpage. I'm very excited to have a number of fascinating guests coming up in the near future before this quarter ends, including Alex Wright, author of the book Glut. IP professors Tim Holbrook and Bobby Quall will be on separately discussing their work, and Professor John Zittrain from Harvard University discussing his most recent work. I'm in the process of scheduling additional guests for the next quarter, and so therefore I do encourage you, for those of you that are interested in suggesting guests, to contact me at dave@hearsayculture.com. Again, that's dave@hearsayculture.com. And you can feel free not only to suggest guests, but to offer feedback and commentary and things I'm doing well and things that need to improve and what have you. I do hope, for those of you who were listening over the last several shows, that you notice a marked increase and improvement in the sound quality. I appreciate everyone's patience as I've now solved that problem, and I don't anticipate that issue coming up again, and I hope I didn't jinx myself by saying that. But again, thank you for listening to Hearsay Culture. Please stay tuned to KZSU for more diverse programming, and I'll look forward to talking to you next week.